Welcome to Forests, Fire and Futures, a new podcast from the School of Forestry at Northern Arizona University. I'm Executive Director Dave Orty. In this podcast series, we're going to share details about our courses, the latest research and technical developments in natural resource stewardship, and the student experience in forestry at NAU. In this episode, we explore how fire shapes ecosystems and how communities are building resilience in the face of growing wildfire challenges. Flames and Futures, Fire Ecology and Resilient Communities.
For thousands of years since the last ice age, people and fire and forests have interacted successfully and sustainably across southwestern landscapes. My name is Pete Foulet. I'm a faculty member in the School of Forestry, specializing in forest ecology. The characteristic fires of the Southwest going back for centuries to millennia, in certain years, such as the year 1748, there were fires across almost all of the mountain ranges of the Southwest. We know this about 1748 from trees that survived those fires, right? Trees that are over 300 years old, they've lived through numerous fires. Large spreading fires that maintained an open ecosystem of grasses and trees has now been converted to a fire regime of very large, stand-replacing crown fires that are the characteristic situation of our time. Now, if we think about how fires have changed and that we see spreading very far to the north as well, such as recent fire seasons in Canada, enormous crown fires are the characteristic situation of our time. Why has this change occurred? There's two main factors. The first is the enormous change in land use associated with the arrival of Anglo-Americans in the late 1800s. The actual removal of fire from the ecosystem for more than a century. Forests regenerated and became more dense. Many young trees grew up that now allows for fire to have a ladder to climb from the surface up into the canopies of the trees. That canopy is now interconnected because the dense trees have crowns that are touching each other. There's a continuous band of fuel there. The other main factor is climate. Climate in the western United States since the mid-1980s has been on a steady warming trend. Our precipitation has remained pretty steady. We have forests that are much drier. It starts getting warmer earlier in the spring. It stays warmer much later in the fall, extending the fire season. These factors mean that the similar kinds of weather and ignition conditions that in the past led to large spreading fires that really did not do any damage, that maintained an open ecosystem of grasses and trees, has now been converted to a fire regime of infrequent but severe fires. We can't control them, and so they burn and cover thousands or hundreds of thousands of acres at one time.
There are really very few disturbance processes that can really change our landscapes for the future overnight or within a few hours, and wildland fire is one of those. My name is Andy Thode. I'm a professor in fire ecology and management. Different ecosystems will have very different endpoints. Right now, we're facing major changes in our Sonoran deserts with invasive species that are coming in and causing fuels to be on the ground where there weren't before, and that can actually carry fire in spaces that used to be empty and didn't carry fire. So we're seeing large fires happening in our deserts. We actually are starting to see potential changes even in higher elevation fire regime types like our mixed conifer, that we're seeing fire work differently because fuels are drying out faster than they used to with changes in climate. We're seeing those fuels become more available at different times than they used to be historically, and so we're seeing bigger windows for fire to burn in those elevation types as well.
Yeah. we can intervene to alter the structure of fuels in our forests. One way is by thinning. It very effectively reduces the likelihood of severe fire. The other part of restoration is restoring the natural frequent surface fire regime. And nowadays, we do that through prescribed fire. Much of this work is increasingly being done with tribal communities. Two specific tribes that I have had the privilege of being able to work with a bit are the Hualapai tribe and the San Carlos Apache tribe, who are leaders in fire use.
In some places, human ignitions make up a massive percentage, like 90% of the ignitions for wildland fires. In northern Arizona, we do have a lot more lightning ignitions. Those ignitions actually can be used in really positive ways. The agencies are getting pretty darn good at being able to use lightning ignitions to get the right kind of effects on our landscapes. We've done some modeling of what fire regimes might look like in the future and how that might shift vegetation types on landscapes with changing climate and how much fuels treatments can help or not help in those scenarios and where we might end up.
My name's Kat Edgley. I'm an assistant professor in the School of Forestry at NAU, and all of my work, my interests, the things I teach are about the human dimensions of forestry, so how people interact with forests across the US. So one of the things that we're really interested in this field of wildfire social science is how communities adapt to fire differently, and that means going to a lot of different communities across the West and understanding why they do or don't gravitate towards different solutions or strategies for reducing fire risk. Fire people love triangles, and there is a fire prevention triangle. It has three different elements that help us prevent fire: education, enforcement, and engineering. So there are different actions that fall under each of those. And what we found was that different kinds of recreationists like different kinds of interventions to reduce fire. So folks maybe visiting from other countries or from out of state might be much more interested in education programming, whereas locals in Flagstaff, they're really concerned about fire risk and they want to see big fines, enforcement, more patrolling because they live here year-round. One thing that was really interesting is we asked people, would they recreate on a red flag warning day? And people said, oh, no, never. We were serving them on a red flag warning day recreating, so we know that they're not getting the right information or they don't know what that means. I have a lot of really, really fantastic undergraduate researchers and graduate researchers who I work with on different grants that I have.
My name is Wills de Grandpre, and I am a Master's of Forestry student. Everything that was interesting to me was through a social science lens. And so sort of at the intersection of wildfire and social sciences, we have this wonderful lady in the School of Forestry. Her name's Kat Edgley. So I just sort of made connections with her and started talking, and I had ideas for a project, and she was just happy to pick it up with me and run with it. We're doing sort of a deep dive into the community of Flagstaff, Arizona. We're looking at ignition risks. Our project has been talking to community members and fire professionals, and we did this through a method we call focus groups, which is sitting down with usually 8 to 12 people and just having sort of a structured conversation. Basically asking all sorts of questions about ignition risks. Where do they see risks coming from in the Flagstaff area? How do they feel about wildfire in general? So a lot of the problems that people were describing were from people coming to the community from other areas for primarily recreational purposes, and they don't really understand the fire ecology or basic fire safety measures that they need to take in order to prevent sparking an accidental wildfire in this area. And so a lot of the solutions were aimed at that. So signage recommendations, for example, on the I-17, putting more signs that say, hey, we're in stage 2 restrictions, just so you know, no campfires allowed. Some of the disconnects that we saw, I guess the biggest thing was that the public wants to see increased enforcement. But the Forest Service is severely underfunded in that sphere. And so the Forest Service or other land management agencies sort of feel they're in a position where they can't really make that happen.
the interesting thing about fire is it doesn't burn the same intensity everywhere. It's really easy to think of a fire sweeping through a forest evenly, but that's not really what happens. My name is Dr. Kelsey Bryant. I am Assistant Professor of Fire, Forestry, and Climate. For me, as a physiologist, one of the big opportunities, if you will, is that fire burns a forest. You go out there, a fire's come through. Most often, if it's not highly severe, there's variable damage. There's char maybe halfway up the tree. Maybe some of the needles are burnt, but not all of them. Maybe they're all red, but they're still there. We don't fully understand exactly how that tree is recovering. Right now, the kind of standard is to come in and cut a tree down if there's 50% of its foliage loss. We looked at trees of variable damage 2 to 3 years after the fire to really see, are these trees 50% or less actually dying? The answer is no. We were seeing trees with 15% green or fewer needles. You look at them from the ground, and this tree looks dead. I'm a tree climber. You get to the top of this and you see this live growth. You see this new growth, and you wouldn't have seen it had you not gotten up there, had we not looked at it with a drone. Fast forward, we did a huge project on it. We actually found that the needles that are left are actually doing as much photosynthesis as 25% of the needles on another tree. Think of them as the MVPs of the tree. And what that tells us is if you leave a tree that's 85% burned, it might actually grow back. So maybe we're cutting a little too early. This is species dependent. It depends on what your forest looks like, how you've managed it in the past. And we actually have been finding that a lot of whether a tree is going to die isn't determined by visible above ground damage. It's based on what we can't see below ground. So whether or not its root network has been destroyed, whether or not all the microbial communities have been destroyed. A lot of my researchers are pairing those physiological understandings, those molecular questions that we can't see, with maybe something that we can measure down the road, whether it's using LIDAR sensing or remote sensing or something like that.
One of the current research projects that I'm most excited about right now is the use of remotely sensed data that we obtain from drones or uncrewed aerial systems over fires where we can measure on a pixel-by-pixel basis, meaning at great detail across a small area, exactly how that fire is burning. We can position a drone over a prescribed fire and observe the ignition of the fire, how it passes through, how it interacts with different fuel types on that landscape, and then we can keep monitoring it as the fire peaks and then dies down. This lets us evaluate the effects of prescribed fire on other resources like wildlife habitat, archaeological resources, and it provides information that can be translated directly back to management to improve the practice of prescribed fire.
You have students who really want to climb and really want to get to the top of the tree. I also have students who tell me they're terrified, but they really want to love physiology and want to measure things at the bottom. So there's a place for everybody.